All right, so much to say, so little time. Second Sunday of the month, and I can tell from my my tweeps over at Twitter that Brooke is trying to stay awake, even though she has to go to work early. Sheila is on a couch with some cocoa. Johnny B says it's time to grab the popcorn, pull out the footstool, and lock the wife in the basement. Oh, dude. At least let her out for Valentine's Day. And Ducky Daisy says, second Sunday of the month, and you know what that means. It's Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, so we're going to make it count, son. Big show tonight, and I can't wait. I probably packed a little too much stuff into the show tonight, but it's okay. The show's got to go on, and we've got a big show to get to tonight. I can't wait. Richard Nixon's darkest secrets in the back half of the show. The update that many of you had been asking for the last time that I did the Tuesday night chat for Coast Insiders at coasttocoastam.com, and that was to bring back Christy Peel for an update on the smiley face killer story. She has a lot to say. It's interesting to have conversations with her off the air about some of the stories that you've been hearing about on the air on Coast to Coast, and we'll get to that a little bit later on this hour. But wait. Because you ordered before midnight, there's more. In fact, there's always more at Twitter. Love to keep in touch with Coasties there every hour of every day. Not that I'm sending out something every hour. Don't get me wrong there. But it's always fun to read your messages, and I try to write back. And so it's a nice way to keep in touch. Crypto news, culture commentary, more than a few laughs. If you want to, if you're on Twitter, it's at Deacon Punnett, DeaconPunnett, at Deacon Punnett. So that way, in between our visits here on the second Sunday of the month on Coast to Coast, we can keep in touch. Now, I'll bring a couple of stories up to date here quickly, and then we're going to jump in with both feet to our first guest. Let me say thank you for all of your concern, kind words. My hearing situation is better. I have been going through a series of treatments for hearing loss and for severe tinnitus. The tinnitus was coming along with a really dreadful headache that had plagued me for about the last year and change. And I had been on the air both for my local radio show and for the national show here on Coast to Coast, and without any relief of this headache for some period of time. Occasionally it would trend downward, but it was pretty consistent. And as I mentioned back in January, I had started a protocol for something called cervicogenic headaches. The thing that they gave me is called zanidine. And it's a simple muscle relaxant, but a couple of days a week, sometimes 3 days a week, I will take zanidine before bed, and that muscle relaxant keeps that what they call the cervicogenic headache away. That's just right where the head connects to the neck, and it's been compromised somehow. That area has where it's crushing down on some nerves, and as a result, it's created kind of this weird sort of series of problems, and those are under control relatively. The tinnitus hasn't gone away yet, but cross your fingers for me. Say a prayer. On Thursday, I go to Mayo, and there I'll have a better idea of the relationship between the tinnitus noise, this phantom sound, this phantom screech that's in my ears, or at least my brain perceives it in my ears, and the cervicogenic headache. So anxiously awaiting news on that and whether or not any help could be available. I continue to try everything, and I am happy to say things are better, and I'm grateful for the little breakthrough. I hope that if any way my experience can inform whatever it is that you're going through or somebody that you know is going through, I'll continue to give you updates on that sometime in March when we visit again. But But I will also then send messages out at on Twitter about that from time to time, and I'll hear back from people. I don't need a lot of advice. I'm great there in that department, but thank you all for your concern. Nonetheless, during the week, I will often send out links to videos. And two this week is what we're going to start with. Two video links I sent out. One was for one that you may have heard about. It was fascinating, really. It was a link for what looked like a woolly mammoth walking through a Siberian river. Or was it a bear with a fish? I know that sounds like, of course, it's got to be a bear with a fish, and it very likely is a bear with a fish. But if you haven't seen it yet, go to coasttocoastam.com and click on woolly mammoth in the Tonight Show description, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, it probably is a bear with a fish, but how long will it be until it is a woolly mammoth? And is it out of the realm of possibility that it could be a woolly mammoth? And then the story of the Iceland lake monster. This was great. This was a slightly fuzzy video of something that looked like the kind of creature that they've been following, looking for in an Icelandic lake for 700 years, 800 years. And it is one more sighting of it, this time on video. We will get an update on both the woolly mammoth story and the Iceland lake monster from monster hunter Ken Gerhard. We've got him lined up, and you'll hear about both of those. You can go take a look at them if you've missed them at coasttocoastam.com. I'll give you a chance to get caught up, and then we'll meet back here in just a few minutes and tell you what you were looking at. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. If you go to the In the News box at coasttocoastam.com, there are some fascinating stories. Love the one that's headlined, Sun Points a Loaded Gun at Us. That's a future Coast to Coast show. It's been one in the past, but I think that's always deserving of an update. And Concordia captain says, okay, whatever, as ship teeters. That came from some new video that was disclosed on the Discovery Channel. You can read the story from Discovery News by linking up to it at coasttocoastam.com, where you can always sign up for the Coast Insider and have that insider audio from any show at any time at your fingertips, and all sorts of ways that you can carry Coast to Coast with you during the week. There's also another news update tonight. If you were watching the Grammys, you knew that they put a pretty good show on tonight. It was great. It was really diverse. A nice tribute to Whitney Houston several times, once at the beginning from LL Cool J, who led the Grammys in prayer, which was a rare moment. Even cooler was they did a pan shot of the audience as LL Cool J had asked for silence and then went into this prayer, and almost every head was bowed. There are a few that were sticking up, people kind of looking around, but everybody else took it as a very reverential moment. It was interesting. And then later on, Jennifer Hudson came out and sang her tribute to Whitney Houston, and a bunch of people at the Grammys dressed stupid. That was the other fun thing. I mean, really ridiculous, you know, excuses for art. I think I may sound a little jaded, but we look at me attention getting costumes that some people were doing to try to grab the cameras at the Grammys last night. Lady Gaga being one of them. I like the headline this morning on The Onion. The Onion put out a news in brief story already. Lady Gaga kidnaps Commissioner Gordon. And they treat her like she's dressed like a Batman supervillain. So why not write about her as though she is one? And then originally, like I said, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, you can click on the links we put up there for the Iceland lake monster and the story of the, is it a woolly mammoth or is it a bear with a fish in the Siberian River story. Ken Gerhard is a cryptozoologist who joins us here on Coast to Coast. Whenever I picture you, Ken, I picture you wearing a hat, right? That's how I see you when you're on, is it Monster Quest that I will see you on the History Channel?
Sometimes on Monster Quest, Ian, and yes, in fact, I am wearing a hat this evening. Thank you.
You say Ken Gerhardt, and I picture a guy in a hat, Adam. So is that a trademark hat, or do you have a variety of them?
I have a little variety, but I guess people refer to that as my trademark. It is very comfortable. So,
well, that's all right. If you're going to spend a lot of time out in the woods, it's only practical to have a hat. And where is it that you live most of the time, Ken?
I'm based here in San Antonio, Texas.
And yet you travel around the United States looking into different reports like the ones that we put up tonight at coasttocoastam.com. And I'm curious what your take is on the video of the Iceland lake monster and then the woolly mammoth. Let's start with the Iceland lake monster. Some people said it's really more a video of maybe a fisherman's net that's picked up debris. Maybe it's just a fuzzy picture of a certain type of whale. What do you see in that video that we've linked at coasttocoastam.com?
Well, Ian, I've got to tell you that I'm not necessarily the biggest proponent of photographic evidence with regard to cryptids, particularly in this technological age of, you know, Photoshop, CGI, YouTube, and so forth.
Sure.
I mean, you know, too, there are just so many variables when it comes to analyzing video, including the reliability and motivation of the source, the circumstances under which the film was shot, and then there's the whole process of processing and editing that takes place. It's like you have to filter through all of these layers in order to discern what you're actually observing, but I guess that kind of makes it for fun conversation, right?
And if we didn't have that, we wouldn't need you, because we need the experts to be able to sit down and sort it out for us.
Well, also, don't forget the human eye as well as the camera lens can be deceived. It all leaves a lot of room for interpretation, in my opinion. And honestly, for some reason, most of the videos out there always seem to be, you know, far away or grainy or just
right.
out of focus.
Slightly fuzzy and out of focus.
And
right.
Ultimately, only last a few seconds, often with an unnaturally abrupt ending. But you know, that being said, I mean, I have to admit, first off, let me start by saying that I won't even attempt to state the name of the lake as my Icelandic.
You notice, like, I haven't brought it up once. I don't even try. I'm with you on that one.
Right. We're on the same page. I will say, at first sight, the footage did appear somewhat promising, but the first thing that struck me is the movement of the subject in the video is vertical and not horizontal. Why is this significant? Because the accepted model of a lake monster or sea serpent, because we probably are talking about the same species here, is based on descriptions of distinct horizontal undulating movements that are reflective of a mammal, usually resulting in a series of humps rising out of the water in succession. And that holds true even with regard to reports we have on record from this particular lake.
Now, I'm going to stop you there and say you're separating out, I think this is an interesting point right away, is that if something were to be able to survive in this environment, it would have to be a self-regulating temperature mammal as opposed to a reptile, which might have the side-to-side undulation, but would find it very difficult to survive in a frozen lake.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that goes without saying.
Well, I think it's good to point out, because I think your mammal point is really good. If it to be a mammal, then it wouldn't be a side-to-side movement. You're saying that would be the what you'd be looking for there is the up and down.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, also, you know, the movement of the subject in the video appears somewhat stilted and mechanical. Not at all what you would expect from a living creature. Snakes, for example, typically have hundreds of vertebrae, resulting in a seamless, fluid motion. And the thing in the video, to me, looks suspiciously angular in its movement. But, you know, we also can't rule out optical illusions. Like you said, you know, fishing nets and you know, illusions caused by temperature inversions in the lake and so forth. So,
well, I think this is a really good point. So that's what when you see that's as a cryptozoologist, somebody who looks for evidence of cryptids everywhere, that's the first thing you see, is it doesn't behave like a mammal. It may have the behavior of a reptile, but it wouldn't make any sense for there to be a, you know, a quote-unquote sea serpent acting in that manner.
Absolutely. I mean, the prevailing theory in cryptozoology is that what we are dealing with are survivals of primitive snake-like whales called zeuglodons, or perhaps some type of unknown species of slender, long-necked pinniped or seal. And, I mean, keep in mind, we're utilizing research that dates back 120 years to the great Dutch biologist A.C. Oudemans, who amassed hundreds of reports logged by sea captains and other experienced observers. So we have a pretty thorough database from which to draw from at this point.
Dude, you know what you're talking about. You can be on any time on Coast to Coast. All right, so the Iceland lake monster, then, you're saying no evidence to support that it would be a mammal or mammalian behavior anyway. So what we can't say what it is, but you tend to feel like you can say pretty clearly what it isn't?
I guess that's fair to say, but I don't think we should close the book necessarily on the lake monster itself. I mean, as you mentioned, there is a long history of reports dating back to the 14th century. Many modern reports. We do have a notable sea serpent sighting by the missionary Hans Egede off the coast of Greenland in 1734. The legends of the Norwegian sea orms. And other geographic considerations. You know, virtually all the lake monsters, for example, Nessie, Champ, Ogopogo, inhabit similar glacial lakes that rest within the same general lines of latitude, which is quite interesting to me.
Yeah, that is interesting.
And also the descriptions, generally speaking, are usually pretty consistent with, a small degree of variation. So, I mean, one thing's for sure, the Earth's oceans and waterways have several secrets to give up still, I'm sure of that. I mean, one need only look at the discovery of, species of beaked whales and, like the megamouth shark that was discovered in recent years.
Right. Things that had been at one time considered to be myth, which then, after they catch one, heck, turns out they catch 100 shortly thereafter, but it just takes one. Okay. Now the woolly mammoth, or is it a bear with a fish video? Again, we're talking about a link we've put up at coasttocoastam.com. You can see it in the Tonight Show box in the upper left-hand corner of the website. We're talking with Ken Gerhard, who's a cryptozoologist. So what do you see in the woolly mammoth video?
Well, let's see. At first, the subject did seem kind of intriguing to me, and it does in some ways resemble a proboscidean or elephant-type creature. But the first thing I noticed was an inconsistent discoloration in the subject, particularly the apparent trunk in comparison to the head and the body. So consequently, the creature presents a striking similarity to a bear with a large fish, perhaps a salmon in its mouth. I mean, that's kind of what it looks like.
Yeah.
But it's also worth noting that the animal's back slopes downwards, and the bears generally display a flat-backed posture. But again, we can't rule out the possibility that the image has been manipulated in some way. So unfortunately, as much as I'd love to say it is in fact a living mammoth, I feel safer saying that it's inconclusive.
Well, and I'll go along with it. And I think it'd have to be a big salmon. And that's part of what, it might be a small bear and a big salmon, or it might be a disproportionately large salmon with a large bear from a distance. I think the downward slope of the back of which you speak, very interesting observation. I think what's fair to say is that unlike perhaps a sea serpent discussion in Icelandic lakes, where these lakes would have been cut off, hundreds of thousands to millions of years ago from, glacial changes, that the woolly mammoth, we know it's really actually some of the last woolly mammoths that would have walked the earth were only, 4,000 years ago, right? I mean, they're not that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's generally accepted that most of the mammoths died out at the end of the Pleistocene about 10,000 years ago, but a relict population of diminutive mammoths lived up until 1600 BC on Wrangel Island off the coast of Siberia.
Yeah, so that's in the ballpark of where this is, and theoretically, I mean, given the vastness of Siberia, given the regular, sort of the desolation of the area, or at least the low population of the area, it's not inconceivable that there could be something that would have survived. But at the same time, I mean, it survived enough to reproduce and continue to have a small population. That one seems like that will come faster than our discovery of Nessie. And as I understand it, we're only maybe within a couple years away from having geneticists bring back the woolly mammoth. I think that project is still on track with the gene splicing they're doing with the existing mammoth DNA. So maybe just a matter of time until we make our own. And heck, what could possibly go wrong with that? Thank you, Ken Gerhard. We're going to have you back on again sometime.
Sounds awesome, Ian. Thanks again for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here on Coast to Coast with you.
Well, it's nice to know that you're ever at the ready, and people can link up to Ken by going to coasttocoastam.com and click on his Facebook link from there. And we'll look forward to seeing you on TV coming up soon, too. And there is always this storyline that lurks out there, also in the mist, kind of the same phenomenon as some of the cryptozoological reports, the smiley face killer stories, stories that exist sort of in the fuzzy videos of our mind. We can't quite see these grainy images, but we seem to have evidence of the ongoing actions of people who seemingly are targeting young male college students. We'll talk about that coming up with a woman who's been following the story. What has she been uncovering or not in these latest reports of the smiley face killer evidence coming up next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. Second Sunday of the month, that's my month, or my week anyway. And I'm loving it. Nice to be back on for a night here on Coast to Coast, saying hi to a bunch of people on the Twitter account who are logging in, David and Ryan, Kermit, and Lieutenant Colonel of Truth says, I like that, Lieutenant Colonel of Truth said of the video we were just talking about, it's a bear with a fish, only a fairly large fish. And everybody else that's weighing in is saying, yeah, wish it were a woolly mammoth video, but it looks like a bear with a fish. We put it up at coasttocoastam.com. Going down, though, to some other people like Ben, who says, love it when you host, gravelly voices aside. Do I have a gravelly voice? I suppose I do. Too much pipe smoking. Donna said, glad to have to found a way to listen to Coast again. On Juan says everyone should stop what they're doing and listen to Coast. I agree. Thank you, Juan. And Richard says, thanks for the updates on your condition. Have the same thing driving me bananas. Cervical disc problem in my past. I was talking about my cervicogenic tinnitus and what's caused some of my hearing loss and headaches and other stuff and getting worked on that, which is going to be good to give you an update on that sometime next month on Coast to Coast. But in April, and this is kind of funny, I'll be on the cover of Tinnitus Today magazine. Yes, you heard me. I'm the cover boy for Tinnitus Today magazine. I think it's a quarterly magazine. I wrote the cover story about this struggle I've had getting doctors to take the tinnitus seriously. And then we just shot a cover for it the other day. I'll let you know more about that when it comes out. Don't rush to your newsstand. However, we will be talking about stories in the news coming in just a moment with Christy Peel, the update on the smiley face killer and Richard Nixon's darkest secrets in the back half of the show. All of that ahead next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I just happened to notice two more people signed up for at Deacon Punnett on Twitter. One of them is Kristen, who is a nocturnal pharmacy tech. And the other is our guest, Christy Peel, who joins us here on Coast to Coast, the Emmy Award-winning news reporter who, are you retired from television news, Christy? Is that the, or are you just on a hiatus while you raise your lovely children?
No, I have a business now, and I'm very happy to be involved in news on the other side of the camera with my clients. So I call myself retired, happily retired from TV.
But you can't help but still have your antenna up on this story. And as you told me on the phone, you hear from Coast to Coast listeners all the time still, every time a story, whether local or one that gets national attention, breaks about another missing college boy, somebody who seemed to fit the profile, the time of day, the background, et cetera, for what seems like a series of murders that are often reported as either suicides or accidental drownings. How often do you hear from Coasties?
Frequently, at least once a week. If there's a hot story or if there's a case that happens, it's, I can get 10 a day. And every now and then I'll just get a random one. Hi, miss hearing you on Coast to Coast. How are you doing? So your viewers are very faithful and very interested. Listeners, sorry.
Well, that's okay. Some of them do look at the radio and wait for something to happen. So that's okay. Now, but you are, you're still following the story. And let's explain for, let's take it back from the beginning. From how this, how the pattern for these investigations first started, and the number of these investigations that had to be reopened as a result of either you or other journalists looking into it.
Well, the very beginning is that I was working as an investigative reporter at KSTP in Minneapolis, and I had been closely following the story of Chris Jenkins, a college student at the University of Minnesota, who was found in the Mississippi River, and his death was turned over to a homicide. And I was closely in contact with his family. They had been contacted by two retired New York detectives who connected with me and believed that they could prove that the death of Chris Jenkins was connected to dozens of others across the country, drowning deaths of young men. And I started looking into that and spent some time with those retired detectives and took that story national. And from our Good Morning America appearance and some other national things that we did, the detectives made the decision not to talk anymore. And I continued to follow it. The families of some of these victims became more than a story to me. They're very close to me. And I have two young sons, and I just thought, what if these were my boys? And it just became, like I said, more than a story. So I continued to follow it through the TV station. After I left, I started a website and have just continued to really look at these and to use my investigative skills. Not that I'm trying to solve these, because I believe law enforcement is going to have to solve them. But what I can do is take the information, the skills that I have. I've teamed up with a couple of other experts, and what we try and do is give families who are looking for answers the tools that they need to take information to law enforcement.
Well, and the keep the conversation going publicly, a place for people to clear information, which is important, even if the police are the ones ultimately charged with solving this crime. But that idea of the public conversation, to go back to the Chris Jenkins story, and then they'll return to the overall pattern of what has been referred to in the past as the smiley face killers, although we're not calling that anymore. The story of the Chris Jenkins case in particular was interesting because police seemed to be so willing to just dismiss it as an accidental drowning. But because of family pressure and pressure brought on by the media, they looked at it again and they had to change their mind.
You know, his family, really diligent. His mother has written a book about it. Her website is legacyofcourage.com, and she's now speaking about it. And they really didn't let the police go. I mean, the Minneapolis police were in their sight every day, all the time, making appointments, going to the press. They really, as difficult as it was for them, used the power of the press in a really positive way, because the story never went away. And people still will run into Jan or Steve Jenkins and say, oh, I remember you, because they were just all over. And because of that, the Minneapolis police really couldn't look the other way. And what they did is they kept interviewing people, kept every time, you know, a tip would come in, they would look at it. And because of their work and the family pressure, they did reopen it. And it is still right now, my understanding, it's definitely ruled a homicide, but it's an open, inactive case.
Okay, but that was the shift from the, if you will, a kind of dismissal. Oh, he was a drunk college kid. He was coming back from a bar. He slipped. He fell in the water. He drowned. But wait, look at the details of the autopsy. Look at the details of the night. And they've had to determine that, in fact, he was murdered. We don't know by whom yet, but somebody did something that brought about his death. In a manner which it can be proven scientifically was not just a simple drowning. Do you remember how the difference between what they had originally said and what they were able to determine later through the autopsy report?
Sure. Initially, what the Jenkins family heard is what so many of these other young men's parents had heard, And that, I think, is really important to understand in this whole situation. It's a different message than when a young woman is missing and when a young man is missing. And when a young woman is missing, frequently the police tell the parents, you know, that they could be victimized. We need to start looking for them right away. And what these young men's parents were hearing is, oh, they probably ran off with a girl. They probably are angry. They ran off their using drugs. They got a hooker. I mean, those kinds of things were actually said to parents. And the parents are saying, no, I know my son. He wouldn't throw his, you know, he wouldn't throw his college career away. He wouldn't do this. And the police wait. And they wait for 2-3 days. And then they start looking. Well, the problem with that is that by that time, oftentimes, the young man is already deceased or they found his body. And it's too late to start 3 days in. It needs to start right away. So what we learned going through the Jenkins is that if you really look at how he was found, and they brought in some experts to look at the water flow and the current, and from where the police initially said that Chris jumped off the bridge to where he was found, it would have been impossible for him to make that jump. In addition, the way that his body presented itself was on its back, facing up, and generally speaking, drowning victims are found face down.
And there were some, there have been a consistency to these reports. When we string them together, when we look at them, you know, from 30,000 feet, we see what seems like a pattern to many of them. And that is college towns, above average students, rare episodes of like binge drinking, seemingly opportunistic crimes where somebody who left the bar alone is never seen again. And a lot of these happening right along the I-94 corridor that cuts from, you know, from here up in Minnesota and cuts all the way to the East Coast. And on either side of that I-94 corridor, there was a disproportionate number of these incidences. Does that remain true?
It does remain true. And we're also primarily seeing that the victims are generally white. They're generally between the ages of 18 and 24. There are some men who don't fit that profile, but we are seeing still that area all the way now from Washington State to New York State, and even as far south as Ohio, Kentucky, Pennsylvania.
Okay. But the belief was, or at least for a while, and this goes back again to those two retired New York police investigators that were tracking a story on the East Coast, is that just like the Jenkins case, there were missing men who seemingly had everything to live for, that when police looked at it through a different lens, they were able to see were victims of foul play, not drowning victims, not suicides.
Right. And what the, you know, what we initially, what I reported initially based on the information from the former police officers to what we know now, I think are two different things.
Right. So let's highlight that so that people have that update. Because originally you were in a different place with their information, and that's when you were on Good Morning America with them and you were fully on board. You're not so much now.
No, and it's interesting because to make the switch from reporter to advocate is really a different mindset. And so as a reporter, I, you know, based on the credentials of these two guys, reported their theory. And once they removed themselves from the picture and I started working closely with the families and started really taking a close look at police reports and getting the information to experts, to forensic pathologists, to attorneys, and other experts, that's when I could really sort of have my own opinion, so to speak, as opposed to being an unbiased source. And once I looked at that information, I came to kind of a different path. And that's when the graffiti and the smiley face and the name and all of that kind of went away from the website, went away from the discussions that I have now.
Okay. So if we're to be more accurate then about these stories, perhaps there was some inflation that was going on of the data, claims that were being made that couldn't be substantiated, perhaps some financial motives involved in other people that have been in the investigation, and that's no way to continue this story. We can't you can't get any credibility on the story with on those terms.
Well, and ultimately, you know, I don't know what exactly those two men have evidence-wise. I do know that most of the families don't talk with them anymore. I know that they haven't ever turned over the information to investigators. And from where I'm sitting, if you have information that can save lives and you don't turn it over and you instead go on television and talk about it, that to me is a problem. Well, so I haven't talked with them for several years.
I will pull this much of the curtain back and say that at the time of this story, I was friendly with an FBI investigator who was also an author, and as a personal favor to me, he looked into these two guys and to their claims and had a phone interview with them and got back to me later by saying, I don't want to get involved with these guys. And he said he wouldn't go into it. I don't know whatever his criteria was, but he just didn't want to, he wasn't buying it. And I'm disappointed in that because I still think that there's something to this story. It just may not be what was originally reported. So again, we're talking with Christy Peel, who's an investigative reporter, former investigative reporter on television, and the person who's behind the story here of the what had been called the Smiley Face Killers. What in the end did you want? How did you want to re-tag the story?
You know, to me, it's really about drowning mysteries, and that's what the website is. We switched it from sfkillers.com to drowningmystery.com, and it really is a mystery. And I think if people focus on finding a way to answer the mystery as opposed to figuring out what graffiti is around, we can actually make some headway. And, you know, police departments, the FBI, have looked into some of these claims of graffiti, that kind of thing, and have thrown it out. So by continuing to talk and look for graffiti and talk about who is doing it really is a detriment and really is holding the whole investigation back.
All right. So before we move forward, then let's talk a little bit more about that graffiti, because originally that seemed like a clue, like there were certain things that were spray painted at the scenes where the bodies would have gone into the river that indicated could have indicated somebody was doing this on purpose.
That's exactly right. That's what the initial story was that there was these two guys that had gone around, these New York former detectives that had gone around looking at different cases, said that whenever they would get to the location of where a body would have gone into the water, they found a smiley face graffiti, and they believed it was done by the same people, and that's one of the main clues that tied together the who in this, you know, in the mystery, is that that was kind of the signature, the calling card, so to speak.
There was one of those crime scenes that was unforgettable to me, and that was the one in Davenport, Iowa, where they had spray paint, or was it in Michigan, and they had spray painted the address, the street address of where a body had gone in Davenport. How am I remembering that wrong?
You're close. It was, yes. They had found in Michigan, apparently, the word Cincinnawa spray painted. And that was an image that we never saw. So that's an image that Cincinnawa is something that they told us that we never saw photographic evidence of. And then they found a body in Iowa on Cincinnawa Street.
That's
interesting. So therefore, they made the connection.
Well, that if they had provided the photographic evidence of that, the odds of that happening, that seems to defy coincidence. So that is the kind of thing that made people go, okay, they're intentionally taunting investigators, right? But let's put a bow on that. We're kind of bringing you up to speed on what had been called the smiley face killer story. And instead, we're going to talk about it from a different perspective. On the other side of the top of the hour, let's talk about it from the perspective of the drowning mysteries that it's a pattern that keeps happening. Is it just a matter of college students having the same behaviors that brings about the same outcome? Is it just that? Or could there be something else involved? Not perhaps a roving band of satanic killers. There was the story in Christy Peel's original reporting of the possibility of somebody who was behind bars who was willing to make an admission that there was a connection between these murders, that this was something that a group of people had were doing as a part of some initiation ceremony or something, which also didn't in the end pan out. So let's talk about it from a different standpoint. Could there be a connection to all of these so-called drowning deaths? And if it's not people driving around up and down the I-94 corridor, pulling over, committing crimes, getting back on the road again, if it's not that, if they're not, then what is the connection between all of these young men and their deaths? That is very interesting. We'll get to that on the way, too. You can always link up to Christy Peel, too, by going to coasttocoastam.com. And then, was he all mobbed up? Was he even more paranoid than we really originally knew? Perhaps a bigger mental case than we know? Nixon's darkest secrets in an hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.